Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and Caroline's taking a break this week, but we have a really fun and interesting and suspenseful book that I think a lot of people would enjoy reading. And our author, our guest today, is Amelia Neymark, and the title of the book is Behind the Lie. Amelia was born in a country that no longer exists, escaped with her parents, lived in Italy for a bit, and ended up in New York, which promptly became a love and a muse. She studied art and was lucky enough to illustrate numerous publications before transitioning to the digital world. She has a particular fascination with psychological thrillers, crime, and suspense. So that's what she writes. In her other life, she's a web developer and designer, an illustrator, and an artist. Amelia is a member of Sisters in Crime, International Thriller Writers, and Mystery Writers of America. And Behind the Lie is the second novel in her in a series. And so we'll talk about both of those. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Amelia.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Very exciting.
Oh, great, great. So you are writing a series. It's a detective series. Private investigator Lainey Bird is the main character. Tell us how you met Lainey.
Okay, so that's a wonderful question. So I met Lainey actually, I'm embarrassed to say, but over 30 years ago, in the form of somebody who later became my husband. He joined the NYPD. He became a detective and he became an undercover detective. And, you know, different people handle the job differently and it affects everybody differently, but it affects everyone. And for him, being an undercover, he just still talks about it like it was the most fun he's ever had in his life. And, you know, there's some cops, they become cops, they never discuss what happens with their families. But my husband would come home and he would just like talk and talk and talk, and he would tell me all these crazy, crazy things that happened, because he'd have to, you know, pretend to be the sort of person who would buy drugs and try to, you know, he would become friends with the dealers, or at least get them to trust him. And, you know, he had outfits. He had a whole like pattern down that he had. He had a different name. He had actually official IDs for his fake name. He was just like a different person, and he got to act and just, and if people got arrested, he'd be arrested because his cover couldn't be blown. So he had all these stories, and, you know, after a while, I just thought, you know, we always thought that he would write it. And then he's not a writer. So then I said, okay, I'll write his stories. And I said, well, that's no fun. And I thought, I'm just going to make him a lady, and you know, and then I'm gonna write his story. So that's how I met Lainey.
That's a great introduction. Yeah. So, and that really answers another one of my questions, which was, how were you able to research the details of what it would be like? Because you know, Lainey's a private investigator, but she's also working very closely with the police. She used to be a police officer. And a lot of, I have, you know, to be frank, I've read a few books, had a few guests at times who basically their knowledge of how that worked was from watching TV. And then they would write it like it was on TV, you know? And you seem to have a little more insight, and now I know why.
Well, I try to be very careful. So I will admit that when I write the original sort of outline and story, I do sort of think about what my knowledge is based on television. But then I sit down with somebody who was a cop, not always my husband, sometimes other people. And I ask, is this possible? Can this happen? And I have to say that more than 50% of the time, the answer is like, no way. In Behind the Lie, I have a scene where, you know, a person comes up to a cop and says, I know something very bad is happening in that house over there. People are being hurt in that house over there. And the way I wrote it, you know, the cops kind of rush in. So I asked my husband, like, can that happen? He's like, no, you can't just go into a house because someone says something's going on in there. Can you imagine? He's like, no, you have to have a warrant. You know, you have to have probable cause. You have to, like, prove to a DA that there's, you know, that there's a reason why you need to go into that house. It can't just be because someone says it, you know?
Right.
So I was like, wow, okay, so now I have to come up with
another way.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. So does your husband read as you're, you know, do you give him chapters as you're going along to read?
Oh, and, No.
That would never
happen. No. What I will do is I will be like, all right, I'm gonna make you a lot of brownies and I'm gonna, you know, pour you some beer and you're gonna sit with me and I'm gonna run these scenarios past you. And that's how it happens. And then after the fact, after it's published and after the audiobook comes out, then he'll actually listen to the whole thing.
So, really? It's not till
yes.
that point? So
yes.
So how
yes.
did he feel about being turned into a woman?
Well, he's both flattered and amused. But when we were, at one point when we were listening to the first book, because we haven't listened to the second one together yet, but when we were listening to the first one, at one point he's like, oh, I wish you would have asked me about that.
Oh.
And I was like, well, you know. Sorry.
Yep. Or say, well, you could read these before they go to press,
yes.
before
no,
it's
yeah.
too late to change.
Yeah.
So apparently he's not, it's not just that he's not a writer, he's not a big reader either, sounds like.
He's definitely not a reader of the kind of stuff that I write.
Okay.
Let me put it that way.
Okay. So, but you are, you've read a lot of, this type. Do you have some favorite writers in this genre?
Oh, yeah. So the one, my go-to writer that my mind always goes to is Hannah French, because she's kind of like brilliant, because she manages to write a good crime story, but she does it through character development. You know, the crimes don't just happen because it's an interesting crime. They happen because of how community is, or of how people are, or how family is. And I absolutely love that.
Well,
but
it
then,
does
like,
seem like
Jewel,
you've, it yeah. seems like you've done that in Behind the Lie too.
Oh, well, you know, I hope so. I hope I was able to get that across.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you were going on with some other authors?
Well, I was going to say Lisa Jewell is another author who anything she writes, I'll just read the moment it comes out.
Isn't yeah. it great when you yeah. find those authors that you want to read everything they write? And I have, unfortunately, over the years found some who then like died or something and then they quit writing.
Oh. Isn't that sad how that happens? You can't write after your death.
I know. So I guess we better do it now while we have the chance.
Yeah. Yeah. Or unless you're like D.C. Andrews, who continues to write long after she died.
That's a good point. Yeah. There are those rare few.
Yeah.
So, Amelia, you were a visual artist. At what point in your life did you know you wanted to write as well? Or did the writing come first?
No, well, the writing was always there, but I guess I never took it seriously as an ambition. You know, like I had an ambition to paint and to, you know, have my work published as a visual artist. And to basically make a living as a visual artist, which, like, now that I think back on it, I'm like, wow, that was like an extremely unrealistic goal, but, you know, it worked, which kind of goes to show that, you know, do what you love and the money will follow. And that definitely happened in my case. But at a certain point, I realized that the writing was actually very fulfilling as well, and that I wanted to try to make it more professional, and I wanted to try to be published as a writer. And that's when I started taking classes. Now that happened about 13 years ago. And I started taking classes and then writing short stories and then eventually novels that I queried with, you know, that didn't go anywhere. And the Hide in Place, which is the first in the series, was the third novel that I wrote and queried with. And I found an agent and a publisher with that.
And why do you, I mean, a lot of writers have books, their first books that don't get published, that sit in a drawer somewhere. Some of them are quite embarrassed by them now. They say they will never see the light of day. How do you feel about your first babies?
Well, the first, it's interesting because on the one hand, like, I know that it wasn't a good novel because I didn't know how to construct a novel. I didn't know anything about how to outline something or pacing or anything. But it, I know that it also, at the same time, I know that it had bits of it that were actually good, like if you just looked at them bits by bits. And I think I don't see myself ever resurrecting it, but I'm not either horribly embarrassed by it. You know, I just know that it wasn't good enough, you know, but
right.
it was a valiant effort.
You know? And what kept you going to write, you know, so you had the first one that didn't go anywhere, the second one didn't go anywhere. What kept you motivated to go on and write the third one?
I mean, I think that's a question that a lot of writers ask themselves on a daily basis. And I think, you know, because even after you get published, like, that question still keeps coming up. But I think the only answer is that you enjoy writing, well, I enjoy writing, and that not writing and not having writing in my life makes my life feel sad. It makes me sad. So it's definitely something that I need to have in my life at this point. And you know, that's really it. That's really, for me, like, I can't think of any other reason to write. Publishing is like the, you know, it's gravy, but it's not why.
You know, I think some people, the publishing is all it is, and that's why they may not be successful.
What do you mean?
Well that they don't actually like writing. They just want to have written. And so a lot of times they don't even finish, and I'm guilty of that too, but because the motivation, the writing itself isn't the motivation.
I mean, obviously, I wanted to get published, and the way I write is guided by what I know is publishable. Mm-hmm. But the driving force is not to get published. The driving force is to write something that makes me happy and that will make a reader happy. I want readers to be happy, you know, and I want to have readers, which means I want to get published. But
right,
the writing has to be satisfying. If it's not it has to be satisfying.
Right.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Amelia Neymark, author of Behind the Lie, which is book two in a series. Do you have a kind of a title for the series?
Well, yeah, the series is the Sylvan series
The
because that's the
Sylvan
town
series,
where, yeah.
right.
Which I guess it's one of those titles that imply, something very calm and beautiful, and
Yes, yeah.
yeah. Of course, there's a lot of like darkness and awfulness underneath it all.
Give us a little bit of a plot summary of maybe both book Hide in Place and Behind the Lie and how they flow into each other. Although behind you can certainly read Behind the Lie without having read Hide in Place first, but kind of an
Yeah.
overall picture of the Sylvan series.
Yeah. So Lainey, she is a cop, and she works this Russian racketeering case in Brooklyn that goes very, very badly for her. She ends up, quitting the NYPD. Her husband leaves her. And basically everything she ever wanted, everything that ever made up her life, it just explodes around her. And that happens before the series begins.
Okay.
So it's basically the arc for the series is for Lainey to become a kind of a, she has to find herself. And part of it, so Hide in Place was her sort of still in shock, not having a place in the world yet, and trying in every way that she can to protect her teenage son, who is, a little weird, a little quirky, and also has a lot of trouble fitting in the world, doesn't know how to fit in the world. And when he disappears, she kind of has to wake up and figure out where has he gone and whether she's responsible and how is she responsible for him being gone. And by the time you get to the second book, she's coming to herself a little more. She's trying to trust people. She's trying to be part of a community and part of a society. And then again, it's the second book, Behind the Lie, begins with a gigantic block party, which is actually very similar to the kind of block parties my neighborhood used to have. But, and you get 600 people on the block, and it kind of lends itself perhaps to not very good things happen. And within the first few pages, you have, a fire, a man drives a truck into his own house, destroying it, and someone is shot. And two people disappear, and that happens, within 15 minutes of the book beginning. So once again, Lainey has to try to figure out what the hell happened while at the same time keeping a hold of her own family and trying to keep her, her family from just going into a bad place. And at the same time, I pivoted to another character in Behind the Lie. And one of the things I kind of wanted to explore was the pressures that women feel to be perfect, to be a perfect wife and a perfect mother and a perfect this and that. And it's impossible. And the way that a person can begin to kind of lose their mind, basically, while trying to be everything to everyone.
So Holly was the character in the first book.
She is. She's introduced in the first book, and as Lainey's friend. And from the very beginning, when I wrote her in the first book, I was thinking, there's just no way that she can be this perfect without having to pay for it somehow, because she really is. She's just kind of Lainey's foil in the first book. She's, she has this perfect little life. She takes care of her family in like the best way possible. She's always, no matter how early in the morning it is, she's always got makeup on. And I thought, she's got to be paying for this somehow. So that's where I started thinking about her for the second book. You know.
And do you have children?
I do. I have a boy.
And the reason I'm asking is because there was one thing about like her relationship with her son that really, that if you're not a parent, it would be hard to have captured this and understand it. And that is that as when they're teenagers, you can't just ask them a question and get a straight answer sometimes. And you can't just tell them what to do. It's more delicate than that.
And the funny thing is that, my son didn't read the books. He did listen to a bit of it. And his first question was like, wait. he literally said this. He's like, wait, am I Alfie? I'm like, no, you are not. You're not him. But when I started writing the first one, I think my son might have been like 14, and I made him a little younger in the book. And in the second book, the character is 15. And I'm not going to say that my relationship with my son is like that, because it isn't. My son is a very different kind of person, but it might be accurate to say that I was that kind of teenager myself. That I was, you know, I got good grades, but I was incredibly closed off. I would not talk to my parents about anything. I had my own life. I had my mind was made up about a whole bunch of things. And now as a parent, I think, how did my parents not lose their heads? You know? they must have just like said to themselves, it will be okay, and just like held their breath until I like grew up. You know?
Well, I'm, you know, my kids are way past teenage. In fact, my grandson's almost a teenager, but I used to say about my son, when he was a teenager, he wouldn't lie to me, but he would refuse to answer.
Yeah.
He just wouldn't answer. So
yeah.
At least he wasn't lying.
I know. And it's not so frustrating. I mean, yeah. I was imagining that, and I think that I have to say, like, I think readers respond really strongly to that relationship between Lainey and her son, because it is frustrating, and he's not a bad kid. That's the thing. Like, he's actually not a bad kid at all. She just has no idea what's going on with him, and she tends to attract trouble.
And if she pushes so, too hard, he retreats even more. And she's afraid of what might happen if she pushes too hard. And I, you know, I've seen parents in that situation.
Yeah, I had to think a lot about how she was going to go about, you know, kind of raising him, you know, and sometimes I felt really bad for her.
Mm-hmm.
Man, she just has no handle on this at all. But in the end, she does, because he knows, he understands that she loves him.
Yeah,
you know, he doesn't dismiss her. He just doesn't want her, you know, controlling him.
Now, you know? His dad isn't in the, doesn't seem to be in the picture at all in Behind the Lie. Is that explained in?
Yeah. In the first book, kind of show a little bit about, the dad basically just like leaves them because Alfie is a difficult child, and he's even more difficult when he's smaller. And the dad is a stay-at-home dad. At a certain point, the dad basically says, I'm done. I'm not going to do this anymore. And he walks away from both of them.
Oh, wow.
Which happens. You know, it happens. I've seen it happen. I thought, man, you know, if there's any way to make my character, you know, be alone with everything that she has to kind of learn how to deal with. This is how it has to happen.
And then, of course, she has a really hard time trusting again.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, Amelia, why don't you read a little bit from Behind the Lie?
Sure. I'm actually going to start from the very beginning and read that first crazy prologue. Okay. Oliver Dubois rammed a pickup truck through his front door on a sweaty midnight in July at the tail end of a massive block party. It wasn't his truck, and the street was close to traffic, so the vehicle's emergence out of darkness and slow rumble up Oak Drive scattered neighbors and guests alike into confused groups on candlelit lawns. With a grind of gears, Oliver veered a sharp left and jumped the curb onto the Dubois front walk. The guests, addled by 12 hours worth of food and alcohol, gawped as the truck butted the front steps as if it were a drunk pausing to gather its thoughts. Oliver idled for a minute, and the instant the neighbor dropped his solo cup of sangria and took a step forward, he revved the engine, vaulted the four steps, hesitated, then gunned the truck's snout into the front door, splintering it. "Whoa, whoa!" the neighbor shouted, and then everyone ran toward the noise, the children weaving in and out between the adults, feet bare on the asphalt and grass. Oliver didn't listen. The vehicle bucked again under his foot and crashed through the doorway, disappearing inside the astonishingly large new opening. Locked inside the sedan across the road, Holly Dubois clawed at the fastened door handle, horrified by the sight of her husband destroying their home. The driver gripped her wrist and held tight. "Let me out," Holly said, in a voice so low and hoarse it hurt. The driver clutched her wrist tighter. They wouldn't have been away by now. Blocks, if not miles away, if it hadn't been for the police barricade someone had set across the side road to keep the party enclosed. The barricade should not have been there. Only the main road was supposed to be blocked. Their car had crept, headlights off, up a dark street parallel to the party, and made the turn that would have taken them to the highway, only to face the blue barriers and, shortly after, the marauding truck. The driver let go of Holly's wrist and reversed the car. Holly scrambled for the door again, struggled to unbuckle her belt, her shoulder a howl of red pain. "You know what happens if you leave," the driver said. Holly clenched her jaw and pressed her fingers against her eyelids, though this did nothing to erase the image of her husband behind the wheel of the truck. A group ran past them, their voices trailing in the dark, reaching Holly through a crack in a window. "Holy shit, is that Oliver?" And, "Don't move him," and, "Call 911. And in the background already, a siren, then another, and another. And then, "Has anyone seen Holly?" Followed by, "Who has the kids?" Finally, the police cars and an ambulance, the EMTs spilling out, the crowd parting. In the sedan, silence. Some 8 hours earlier, the height of the party had seen over 400 people milling up and down Oak Drive, drinking beer and cocktails, ladling sangria from giant tubs with ice islands. An entire tent had been devoted to food, another to games. The children squealed as they jumped inside bounce houses and on trampolines, and the adults yammered about the weather, sports, and local school intrigues. Oak Drive was the friendliest block in Sylvan, a small municipality in upstate New York, with the winding routes, forests, and horse farms reminiscent of quaint 18th century paintings and the split levels, colonials, and white-collar politics of suburbia. The Dubois family, or more specifically, Holly, was the social center of the town. Her clan had lived in Sylvan for three generations, in the very house now sporting a truck-sized hole in its facade. As the car backed up with care, its headlights still off, a child wandered away from the noise and lights, his shoulder-length hair backlit. "Kiki," Holly shouted, loud enough for her son to snap his head in the car's direction. But it was too late. The car was rolling backward, around the corner, doing a K-turn. She rattled the door and lowered the window, aiming to climb out, but the window stopped at a 5-inch gap, and she felt her chest contract as if an iron hoop crushed her ribs. This is how people have heart attacks and die, she thought, and under that, I don't want to die. Let me out, she said once she could breathe again. F you, said her companion. The breeze changed then, and an acrid odor swept up the streets, making Holly's eyes water, settling grit in her throat. My God, someone yelled as they drove past the manicured lawn. Fire! The driver tapped the brakes, letting the car slow, made a sudden left, and took them back toward the block party and the smoke. At the bottom of the hill, hidden from view by a hedge of spruces, bright yellow and red flames snapped into the night air, blackening the siding of 46 Oak Drive. Dimmed windows, empty driveway. Empty driveway. With a jolt, Holly realized the blue pickup truck, now blanketed with siding and drywall inside her living room, belonged here, to the couple who'd moved in 6 months ago, to the body still sprawled, as far as she knew, in a pool of blood in the den. A soft sound escaped her associate, a hitched breath. Then more sirens, noise, and shouting, and they were reversing again, a squeal of tires, and off, away.
And that gets you right into the action.
Yeah.
So, in Behind the Lie, the I don't want to give any spoilers, but anyway, there are some characters with Russian heritage. And So tell us a little bit about why you did that and what your background is.
Yeah, I can't get away from the Russians. I'm gonna try to get away from them next time. But I was born in the Soviet Union, and I came here as a child. The interesting thing is, for some reason, when I think of writing about criminals, I immediately start thinking of making them Russian. And partly it's because, it's kind of fun to write about people whose cultural background is different, because I think I'm kind of showing something that maybe readers won't necessarily be familiar with, and that's always fun to do. And partly because I think the crime that they commit is almost, I'm not going to say, I can understand Russians committing that crime. I don't know why. But also, I just kind of wanted to introduce a certain cultural differences. So, for example, it is a couple, and one member of the couple is extremely spiritual, to the point of being extremely superstitious. There's like this line that is crossed where there's a real belief in faith spirits, and it's almost a religion, although not quite. And then the other person is the opposite of that, is very, very materialistic and non-religious in any way whatsoever. But they make this incredibly tight team together, and they love each other deeply because and despite of these differences that have fit. And I think one of the themes in really that I write about is love and all the different ways that people just are connected to each other, and the ways in which they connect and the reasons. So that was kind of where that came from.
Now, when you, like, your bio says that you came from a country that no longer exists. So that's the Soviet Union.
Yeah, that is
right. And what part of the Soviet Union were you from? Like where, what is it now?
So I was born in Russia, I mean, in Moscow. And I grew up in Moscow, and I still have some family there. So it definitely is still Russia,
Okay.
although, you know, big giant parts of it are no longer,
Right,
no longer
right.
that, but.
And how did you, like, how did you leave? How did you get out?
So in the late 70s and through to the mid 80s, there was this big push to let all the Soviet Jews leave. And there's all kinds of thoughts about why that came around, but, you know, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. Between those years, I think, I don't know. I don't know what the exact numbers are, but I'm guessing like well over 50% of all the Soviet Jews left because all of a sudden we could leave. Because the one thing about the Soviet Union is that you actually could not leave there. It wasn't even a matter of, you know, being able to immigrate somewhere else. It was a matter of you would not be allowed to leave. Nobody could leave. And when the Jews were allowed to leave, the ethnic Russians still couldn't. So that's why it was this exodus that happened, and we were able to be part of that. And we actually, because of how that was being done, we were refugees. We were considered officially refugees. And when you were emigrating at that time, you didn't come directly to America, for example. You kind of lived in this like stateless refugee way of being in different countries. And we spent about 5 months, almost 6 months in Italy, waiting for some country to give us a visa. And we applied to a bunch of different countries. And then America gave us a visa, and we ended up in New York. And I've been grateful for that ever since, because it's just been a giant, huge, amazing gift, you know, to end up here.
And was it New York City that you've?
It was. Yeah, it was New York City. We ended up living in Queens, and I lived there until I graduated college.
And now your books are set in upstate New York. So is that where you are now?
Yes, we went up and we moved up into upstate New York, and it's just so beautiful here. It's beautiful, and it's weird because it's very much a small town. You know, it's comprised of a lot of very small towns, but because it's so close to New York City, it's also like a very metropolitan area at the same time. And a lot of artists, writers who can't afford New York anymore, New York City, are moving up into the Hudson Valley. So the Hudson Valley is basically becoming this, you know, incredibly interesting place to live because of that. Yeah.
And you've got four seasons there, but winters are kind of rough, aren't they?
Winters are rough, but I don't mind. I don't mind. We have our wood burning stove, you know. And you know, my husband has a snowblower, so. And you know, I work from home, so it's not a big deal.
Right. You know, my 9-year-old granddaughter wants to go to New York. 9 years old, and that's like for vacation. That's where she wants to go, is New York.
In the winter.
Well, not in the winter, not necessarily in the winter, but just at some point she wants to go to New York, which, you know, I'm not sure that I would have ever even have thought of that at that age, you know, as a destination, you know, as Disneyland, there's the beach or
that's
something like that. But no, she wants to go to New York.
So what is in her mind?
I am not absolutely sure. What she's planning to do there.
That's so funny.
I know.
That's very funny.
But
well, I mean, yeah, go ahead.
I think plays, going to Broadway, I think. But other than that, I really don't know.
That's so funny. I feel like I grew up in New York in the best possible time when you could be young in New York. It was amazing.
So how old were you when you came to New York?
So I was 8. And actually I might have turned 9 I turned 9 in Italy. So I was 8 when we left Russia and I was 9 by the time I arrived in New York, and it was great.
Now, one of your Russian characters, the spiritual one, reads cards as a fortune-telling exercise.
So that I picked up because that's what my mom did. So what happened was, it's not tarot cards, it's actual playing cards. And there's there's a Russian deck of playing cards that's only 36 cards. It's everything under the 6 is removed. So like no 5, none of that. And there's like a way to lay them out and read the future. And what happened was that right at the end of the 19th century, that kind of arrived into Russia from France, and that way of telling the future arrived. And people really kind of got into it and started doing it. And then the revolution happened. And then it was such a gigantic upheaval to all of society. And then under communism, there really wasn't a lot. Like, it wasn't like you could really, there wasn't a lot to do. it was a relatively poor way of existing by comparison to sort of the American way of existing. And so this fortune telling thing became just this gigantic phenomenon that all the women in many, many, like most women and most families had a deck of cards and they would tell futures. And it was just something everybody did. And it transcended, you know, all of society. It could be, you know, your peasant grandmother in your wooden hut somewhere in Siberia, or it could be, you know, an engineer in a Moscow apartment building like my mother, you know.
Wow.
But it was incredibly widespread.
And did people really believe in it, or was it just sort of for fun?
It was definitely for fun, but there's this thread of superstition that runs through Russian culture not a century of communism, none of that could, you know, scrape that away. So yeah, a little bit. People kind of did. It's like they kind of believe it. It's kind of fun. Kind of not believe it, but maybe believe it. you know, kind of like that.
So do you do it? Do you tell the cards?
I actually found my mom's cards when I was writing it and I was looking at them. And I used to know how to do it, and I still remember part of it. I remember, I definitely remember what the cards meant, but I haven't done it in a very long time. But there's definitely certain combinations of cards that, like, if I saw them right now, I would feel uneasy.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Like for example, the Ace of Spades, and again, just like with the tarot, it depends which way it's facing. So if it's upside down or right side up. So if it's upside down, it's a really bad. I mean, that's like, that's bad, bad, bad stuff. if it's the other way where it looks like a little cup, then it's a really good party.
Oh. <You know?
laughs> So you combine, if you combine like the Ace of Spades with the Queen of Spades, forget it. Start writing your will right now.
Oh, wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Emilia Neymark, author of Behind the Lie. Now, kind of what's behind the lie is financial difficulty of a a good person getting into financial difficulty through no fault of their own, which can happen in a number of ways in the United States. One of the main ones being medical crises, and that is part of what happened here, although it wasn't her medical problem, it was a family member, and that she then tried to help out. So why did you decide to incorporate this as part of the plot of the book, and how did you know what that was like?
Well, I mean, frankly, watching the news and watching my friends, and it's so horrifying. It's just horrifying how easy it is for a family that is middle class, owns a home, has a job, has insurance, and how easy it is to still lose everything if somebody gets sick. I mean, I've witnessed it happen. I've witnessed, people be just completely destroyed by there not really being any. I don't even know if I can say there's no safety net, because I guess insurance is considered a safety net. But it's just not enough. It's not enough. And I was thinking, if you have this character like how Holly is, the way that she wants to just protect everybody and save everyone and everything, and she can't. It's not possible. And she ends up cannibalizing her own family and the well-being of really herself and everybody around her in trying to help everyone. And how do you get out of that? How do you get through that? When someone who's really dear to you becomes very sick and you have to help them, and it eats everything.
Yeah. And then addiction too can really destroy a family.
And I've obviously, I've seen that. I've seen that happen, and it's rough, writing is writing about conflict. And one of the things I think is writing about women is writing about suspense. because you put a lot of pressures onto a character and then see how they dance. But I don't even think I put very unrealistic pressures on her. I think the pressures I put on her were very, very realistic. It's just, she maybe kind of lost her mind a little bit and how she wanted to handle it.
Right. Well, and part of that was from a childhood trauma.
Right.
And so that can have a big impact, a trauma that she never maybe fully dealt with.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, Amelia, let's talk a little bit about your writing process. Do you write every day? Do you write on computer, or do you ever write longhand? Are you a plotter or a pantser?
So I definitely am a plotter. I try to write an outline and as good of an outline as I can do. Sometimes it takes me, even a couple of months to write a good outline. And then I write a draft. And when I'm in the draft writing mode, I make it a point to write every day. It doesn't always happen every day, but that's definitely a point to do it, to try. And one of the things that I end up then doing in the middle of all this is doing character studies. So if I feel that I'm at a point and I'm not really sure how a scene is supposed to go, I'll write a character study that has nothing to do with that scene, but that has to do with something that character might have faced at some point in their lives in the past. once I know that, then I'll know how to write a scene. And then at a certain point, I re-outline. Because an outline is from the outside in, but for me, a story is really from the inside out. So once I have my draft, I know where the outline was imposing a plot point that is not connected to what the characters really are. So then I have to sit down and re-outline, and then I do my second and third draft. And by the time I'm on my third draft, I can start sending it to beta readers.
And so it sounds like you've really developed you've really refined your process.
It's definitely an ongoing process, absolutely. Because going forward, I've discovered that it actually works differently when you have a publisher. you can't just sit down and like write a book and then hand it in. It has to be approved ahead of time, which means there has to be a very, very solid outline and synopsis ahead of time. And that's a very different way of writing. And that's something I still have to perfect. That's something I still have. I'm still kind of trying to work on being good at that. But it's all a learning process and it's all fun.
So how did you find your publisher? And who is your publisher?
So my publisher is Crooked Lane Books. And it's an imprint of Penguin Random House. And so I found my agent, and then with the agent, who's Paula Mounier, who's great. She's really good. I'm incredibly grateful to have her. And with her, we went on submission to, I think, I don't know, 10 or 12 different publishers. And a few weeks into the pandemic, when the pandemic started, Crooked Lane Books said yes to Hide in Place. And then it was a two-book deal, which was amazing.
Wow.
Considering it was, and it was like during the pandemic. And I was like, all right, well, life is really weird now. So, yeah, that's how I spent my pandemic years.
And Crooked Lane focuses mostly on mystery books, I think.
Yeah, they do. They do a lot of mysteries, a lot of suspense, a lot of thrillers, a lot of cozies. That is definitely in crime. So that's definitely their niche.
Right.
And there's some really great books that they put out, I have to say.
Now, you've also done a lot of short stories.
Yes.
Are you still writing short stories? And how did you get some of them published?
So short stories, the amazing thing is that it never occurred to me that writing short stories could be a viable way to get a publishing career started, but turns out that it is. And because it doesn't, it takes maybe a month and a half to perfect a short story. And then I can send it into a ton of places. And then if it gets published, I have a publishing credit. And then depending on where it gets published, it actually qualifies for me to enter it for awards. So there's always this exciting chance that it could be end up somewhere really great. And one of them actually ended up in an anthology that I'm still kind of pinching myself about. But the anthology came out about a year ago, and it's called When a Stranger Comes to Town. And I'm in this book with like authors like Joe Hill, and Michael Connelly. I mean, it's just mind blowing.
Wow.
So I really like writing short stories, and yes, I'm still writing them. And it's, like I said, it's been a weird year. it's been an interesting year.
So Behind the Light just came out, I believe, in February of 2022. Yeah. And what are you working on now?
So I have another project that I'm trying to, that I'm hoping will get the green light. So that's what I'm working on. And I can't really say more about that, but it's, I would, I'm very excited to work on it. If
Do
I'm,
you anticipate Lainey showing up in future books?
I would like her to, because I think she still has a little bit more growing to do. And I would like, you know, to me, she's a person. She's just like a, she's not a character. She's a person. And I actually want her to be happy. So I would like for her to get to a point where she's better adjusted and kind of understands herself a little more, you know, and maybe has nicer things in her life.
Yeah, maybe she actually lets that nice guy in
Maybe,
a
yeah,
little
right?
bit. Yep.
I like him a lot. He's cute.
Yeah, she really just hasn't given him much of a chance.
I know. She can't even like imagine. She can't even picture it. Every time she pictures it, she's like, "No, I can't. Like that can't happen ever again."
One other, looks like we only have a couple minutes left, so I just want to ask you if you have any advice for someone working on trying to get their first book published.
I think the only advice is persistence. If writing is what makes you happy, write the best thing that you can, and you know, don't. I would say write because you love writing. That's really the only advice. Because the more you write, the better you're gonna get. That's, and it's gonna happen. Persistence and loving what you do are the two main things that basically lead to a good career as a published author.
I think that is great advice. So thank you so much for being with us today, Amelia.
And thank you so much for having me. This was great. I had a great time talking to you. Thank you.
Oh, and we usually close with a quote. So I looked up a quote on superstition, because that does play a little bit of a part. It's not the main theme of the book, but there is a little, you mentioned of one of the characters being superstitious. And Voltaire said, "Superstition is to religion what astrology is to astronomy, the mad daughter of a wise mother. These daughters have too long dominated the earth."
Wow, I love that. And that is such a perfect quote for this book.
Awesome. Well,
Thank
thank you again,
you.
and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Okay.
Bye bye.
Thank you very much. Bye.